Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things test automation related. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com. And today we're going to be speaking with Alan Page of Microsoft. Alan is the lead author of How We Test Software at Microsoft. He's also contributed to a bunch of other books. He's been in the software industry for over 20 years. He speaks at a bunch of conferences. So Alan knows testing. So you're going to want to listen to this episode. But first, let's hear it for our awesome sponsor, Sauce Labs. Today's episode is sponsored by Sauce Labs. Sauce Labs makes test automation awesome. Sauce's cloud-based Selenium Grid helps developers test web and mobile apps across more than 400 browser and OS platforms. Sauce also supports Appium and popular JavaScript unit testing frameworks and integrates with all the top programming languages, test frameworks, and CI systems. With built-in video recording, debugging tools, and secure tunneling for firewall testing, Sauce helps you ship better software faster. Sign up at saucelabs.com with promo code TESTTALKS14 and get 20 hours of automated testing for free. So have you ever wondered how testing is done at big companies like Microsoft? Do you want to know what it takes to succeed with testing and automation across a huge enterprise that has a bunch of different products and technologies? Alan has seen it all, and he shares his years of testing wisdom. So your ears will be ringing from all the test automation awesomeness knowledge bombs Alan drops in this episode. So check it out. Hey, Alan. Welcome to Test Talks.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Cool. So before we get started, could you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
A little bit more. I could fill your whole hour. I'll try and do it in 60 seconds or less. So I have been in software testing since about 1993. It's a long time ago. I've been at Microsoft since 1995, and I've worked on a whole bunch of different projects here. I started off on the Windows 95 team, and I worked on a bunch of flavors of Windows. Worked on Windows CE, which was the old embedded version of Windows for a while. I worked on very early versions of Internet Explorer, way before 6. You can't blame me for that. I worked in a group called Engineering Excellence for a while, which no longer exists at Microsoft. And while I was there, I did spend almost 2 years as the director of test excellence. I wrote a book called How We Test Software at Microsoft. I wrote chapters for books, Beautiful Testing and Dorothy Graham's Experiences in Test Automation. I put together an ebook of my blog posts called The A Word, Under the Covers of Test Automation, which is available on LeanPub. I worked on Xbox for a while.
Cool.
And that was fun. I'd like to say my 2 years working for Xbox One was the best 5 years of my career.
Nice.
That was a lot of fun. And since then, I've been working on a soon-to-be but not yet announced product that's part of it'll be a Windows Phone app eventually.
It's not HoloLens?
No, okay. No, I'm not. But they're in the same building as me.
Oh,
they're
cool.
Upstairs. So HoloLens is here. I have a lot of friends from Xbox that work on that team, but I am not working on the HoloLens team.
Cool.
That pretty much gets us to today. There's a lot of details in there, but I go to conferences once in a while. I should probably plug that I'm going to be at Star Canada in Vancouver in June doing a tutorial and a keynote. So other than that, I'm trying to cut my conference speaking down to once or twice a year. So that's the one for this year probably.
Great. So Alan, the first thing that strikes me is it seems like there's been a lot of changes going on at Microsoft, especially with the new CEO. So in regards to your book, How We Test Software at Microsoft, how much has changed since that book and now?
A lifetime.
Okay.
in 6 years or 7 years since I first started writing it or so. I didn't know where to start, how much it's different. A lot of the techniques in there described are things that are still done. They're just done often done differently. We have a lot of what I'll call unified engineering teams at Microsoft. Eventually, they'll just be called engineering teams. But we have a lot of teams where there aren't specific roles for testers. So those activities we talk about, you know, the looking at some of the technical things around test case design or functional test design, I don't like the word test case that much. Functional test design or coverage, those are all still done, but less so by the test team and more as part of sort of the day-to-day work of everyone on the team. There's also a much huger emphasis on, I think I wrote one chapter, in fact, I remember I wrote one chapter on customer feedback systems where I talked about things like our crash reporting systems and what we used to call SQIM. I know what it stands for, SQM, which was a way to get data from customers' usage patterns. But what we did 6-7 years ago compared to now is nothing. Today, we're heavily dependent on that, what we call telemetry, remote metrics from customers, from customer usage, internal beta usage, et cetera. We get that almost in real time in a lot of cases, very small delay versus what we used to get, a day or 2 or 3 days later and look at an aggregate. And also it's a lot more emphasis on how to analyze that data, both for business intelligence to know what's going on and then looking for insights in more of the data sciencey part of the world. So that's probably one of the biggest shifts. And there'd be a whole, I've talked before about how, in fact, my keynote at STAR, to loop back my plug, is talking about all these things, how much is different and what's changed. So those are probably the biggest things. I think who does the activity is not necessarily the SDET. In fact, that first portion of the book that talks about the structure of the company and the roles of what we call the software design engineer and test, those are hugely changed, mainly because a lot of teams don't have testers. In fact, although it's hard to describe what a tester does anymore, I've talked a lot about generalizing specialists and I have a specialization in testing and quality and how software quality is built, but I'm really more of the craftsman of the team than the tester. Our developers are actually writing pretty good tests on our team, but my job is sort of look end to end and make sure I know where the holes are and make sure that we're actually approaching engineering in the proper way to make quality software and hopefully build something that's fun and usable for customers. But the short answer is that it's changed a lot and not that, well, just, some things haven't changed, but a lot has changed.
Okay, perfect. Well, I may be aging myself here, but back in the day, Microsoft was the technology company to work for. So one of the things that I always threw out was, I think there used to be a statistic saying, there was one test for each developer at Microsoft. But so now it sounds like that's not how it is, that it almost sounds like Microsoft did exactly what some of the other companies have been doing when they call shift left.
Yes.
So you're saying most of your developers now are, the testing is part of the actual development process. It's not something that's done at the end of the development life cycle.
Correct. That staged part, even on our very formal like desktop, big thick application teams, the functional testing, like does this work? For years and years, my job as a tester at Microsoft was basically to write unit tests. Because I'd get code and I'd, blow on it lightly and it would fall over. Those days are rare. It's actually harder to find bugs in our code. There's still bugs that, but the expectation is that functional bugs are found during the coding process before it ever gets checked in or before it ever makes it into a branch that anyone would care about looking at. So, yeah, that part of shift left has happened a lot. There's still, I think there's plenty of room for people like me and a lot of sort of lifetime quality or test folks to look at reliability, performance, security, end-to-end integration, especially how you're building something like Windows. You have, doesn't matter how functional every little bit of code is, when you put it all together, you need it to be both usable, which is hard. I've heard this many times in the past that Microsoft makes wonderfully functional products that work nicely that my wife can't use. So there's a lot of room for looking at how things fit together end to end and making some good decisions there. But there's also things that, as beyond just usability, pieces that don't quite fit together when you put the whole system together. And that's where our test specialists really fit in. But I don't know what the ratio is across the company anymore. I probably give you two different ratios. There'd be the ratio of how many people are called testers versus how many people are called developers. Then there's the ratio of how many people are in sort of a test specialist kind of role versus people who write code all day. And I'd have to guess on both of them. I mean, my title now is just software engineer. Although I spend most of my day doing very different tasks than the software engineer in the office next to me does. I think that's okay. I think that's healthy. By the way, no matter which way I slice it from those two different angles, neither one is close to that one-to-one we used to have. But that one-to-one was necessary because for a long time, the role of the tester was this weird, I can be open here. It was a weird sort of relationship where, what's the word I'm looking for?
Codependent
relationship. Yeah. Where the developer would give the tester the code, expecting them to find bugs, and the tester would then validate themselves by finding bugs and giving it back to them, and which was made both, you know, this nice little dependency. You have your little dev partner, and they give you code, and you give them bugs, and you go back and forth, and it's great. But when you think about it, it's really wasteful and inefficient. Those days are gone, thank goodness.
I thought I read somewhere, though, that you said it takes a certain kind of thinking for a tester in order to write good tests. So how did Microsoft make that transformation then, that they feel confident enough that their developers also are going to write good tests?
It depends on the definition or granularity of tests.
Okay.
I think developers can write, almost every developer I know can write very good functional tests.
Yep.
Does this because they have an intent. Like, this should do this. I can write a test to make sure this does this. I think they're very good at that. Not great. And I actually spent, as this team I'm on a year ago, made this shift left where developers were going to own all the functional testing. I probably spent 3 months straight reviewing code about 2 to 3 hours a day of all the check-ins for our team, just reviewing the test code and giving feedback. And I don't need to do that anymore because our developers, for the most part, write pretty good tests, and they get that, they kind of get it now. Like, oh, all the things we learned over the years, I tried to ram down their throats in about 2 to 3 months. Tests should be diagnosable. When it fails, it should mean something. Getting rid of the flaky tests, et cetera, et cetera. So that part, they just need a little bit of training, and they can do pretty well at. There is, however, and I'm sure I've mentioned this before, great testers from those that investigate the software and can find the holes in the larger system,
right,
are good systems thinkers. They see the system as a whole. They can figure out how piece A should integrate with piece B and what that should look like and when it's working and when it's not working. And they also have some specialties around maybe some non-functional areas or whatever. But those kind of people are still employed, and we still have, like, me. And we find areas to specialize, like in helping developers write tests, but we're also, you know, the reason I'm employed is because I'm here to look at the big picture of how things fit together and make sure we're doing the right thing, which is more of that tester mindset. You know, I'm a big fan of the concept of, you know, generalizing specialists, specializing generalists. I think the bulk of our team, the development team, their day-to-day role is to implement code, test that code, make sure it works, and integrate it into the system. There's a smaller portion of us who look at how that's all fitting together and finding the holes in that. It's a different shift and a different approach, and hopefully there's enough of the what we learned in the old world around that we don't let things fall through the cracks. But it seems a lot more efficient to me just to do it that way. But anyway, to answer your question, functional tests, devs can be very good at writing. There's no reason they can't write their own unit and, you know, beyond unit functional tests. We could actually, on our team, we call them inner loop and outer loop, and I actually just call them short tests and long tests. And our development team owns writing all the short tests, the things that, and also those things are very biased towards verification, pass fail. The kind of tests that our, what we call our quality team writes, much smaller team. We also do a lot of the data analysis work, but we write longer tests that are more investigative. You know, a perf test may not pass or fail. In fact, I don't know, you know, unless you're setting a threshold, wouldn't pass or fail, but it gives you information that lets you know about that you have to interpret. Reliability tests are often the same way. Beyond crashes, are there error paths are getting hit, which ones, and we investigate to figure out if it's a problem or not and how to diagnose that and use that information for the future. But a lot of the tests that people like me write are tests that don't have a pass-fail criteria at the end. They give us some information about the state of the system that we can use in context with all of our other things that have given us information about the state of the system to let us know, to give us some informed decisions on how the software is behaving.
When you say tests, what kind of tests are these? I know in your book, you say 95% of all automation against a GUI is a waste of time. So I'm just curious to know, when you say testing, what kind of testing are you doing?
I should probably clarify the GUI thing before I make everybody mad, but 95% of the time, 95% of the people will write bad GUI automation just because it's a very difficult thing to do.
Right.
If you have well-designed software, it can be easier. If you're using, there's all kinds of things you can do that will make it easier for you to be successful, but it's a scary place to be because there's just lots of fragility there. And I don't like flaky tests. It's funny. I went to the Google Test Automation Conference, and I'll get to your question eventually. I went to the Google Test Automation Conference last fall, and I think not every single, but almost every single speaker, at least at one point, brought up the concept of flaky tests and what to do with them. So I was joking around calling it, next year we should have the Flaky Test Automation Conference. And those aren't even all GUI tests, but it's sort of the what we've learned, and those of us that have written automation over the years, is that it's very difficult to write trustworthy automation where if it fails, we go, oh, it's a product bug automatically.
Right.
We go look at it and go, well, let me see if it's a test bug first. Okay, it's not, it's a product bug. And we do silly things like, the test failed, I'll run it again. Okay, it passed, it's fine. And I just, you know, bang my head against the desk. No, 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 no. All right, so what kind of automation do we write? For the long tests or those outer loop tests, we're looking at things like, let me go back to Xbox and talk a little bit about there. that'll be easier for me to keep myself out of trouble. So we may have a long test that puts a new build on the Xbox and then launches some apps that run in one of the operating systems, because Xbox has three operating systems, and then have it switch and sort of try and maybe I'm talking as I think, which rarely works out. We may try and, for a stress type test, may try and simulate a few months of actions in a day. So we're gonna start games, stop games. We're gonna put games into that windowed state. We're gonna switch over to apps in the other operating system. We're gonna do a search. We're gonna initiate a Skype call, etc. So those kinds of things we can all do at a layer below the GUI and be pretty accurate on knowing that when we call the action is going to work. We're going to look for system reliability issues. We're going to write the tests that run. In addition to that, we did have a nightly stress mix, which is distributed, that we would write and have all kinds of crazy things happening to the file system, etc., trying to find areas where the Xbox or the operating system may crash, very similar to what Windows does. We're going to write tests that capture frame rate over time while different things are going on to make sure they meet sort of the specs that we thought they would as far as videos playing or frame rates for games, etc. Things like that. Whereas the functional test the developer may write make sure that the video plays and that there are no dropped frames within the first 30 seconds. Because those functional tests that the developer team usually writes are short, want them to be quick because they don't want to have to wait an hour to decide whether the change they made is good to check in.
Yep.
Or longer. They want to know, okay, it looks like I didn't cause any regressions. We're going to go from there. Another area where we wrote a lot of investigative tests was around the Kinect device. We generated a lot of simulation around objects in the room. So we could try and simulate four players with a dog walking through, with a plant over here, with this kind of lighting, with that kind of lighting, this size room, etc., to try and find areas where our, what we call skeletal tracking, wasn't working as well as we wanted it to. So things like that, things that are a little more in depth and long, we'll write automation for those because doing those manually is very difficult and time consuming. So the kind of tests we're writing, in short, after that long answer, is things that may take a lot longer to run, things that give us more information about the system. And there's some examples in there that hopefully will help.
Definitely. So I guess it almost sounds like when you say automation, you're not against automation. It just sounds like you're more for lower level automation, like API automation.
Yeah. And to be clear, maybe a better way to put that is I am against automation that attempts to simulate what the user does. That to me, that's just silly. And I think that's unfortunately, what I see a lot of teams do when they adopt some tool is, oh, the user's going to do this and this and this, and I'll make sure they can do this on every build. Again, you can do that a little bit for, you know, a website using Selenium to make sure that as a quick verification test, but doing anything complex, I think the more complex you get in those scenarios, the more prone you are to error. I'd rather use automation, or as many people call it, sort of that programming-assisted testing to make it easier for me to do complex actions reliably.
I guess we're doing it wrong where I am. But we're doing behavior-driven development. And
I love BDD.
Okay, but what we're doing though is when they do BDD, and even though they don't listen to me, I say we should do more low level tests. They make it all UI level because they say, "Oh, we're a medical device. We need to simulate exactly what our user is going to do," and they don't understand that even if the test is at a GUI level, it's not exactly what a user is going to do because it's calling usually a JavaScript or something that it's not even being rendered in a browser, and sometimes we're doing hooks into those JavaScript calls. So how do you get around that? Or how would you try to educate someone that doesn't understand exactly what should be automated or at what level it should be automated at?
You're never going to simulate the user. Yep. It shouldn't be hard, but it's a hard hump to get over often. I think you look for data to help back up where it doesn't help. And every time you get to a point where either the automation passes and the UI is all screwed up, or the automation fails and it shouldn't, and it should have passed because someone changed the UI and didn't change the automation. All those things give you data that helps you make a shift and say, look, if we had these things that passed that should have failed because we didn't have actual eyes on this, we relied on the automation, and these things failed and should have passed because automation was flaky because we're trying to manipulate the UI directly. All those things give you data that helps you make a shift. And what I prefer to do, if I were in charge, I would make sure that the application can be automated without manipulating the UI. You know, model view controller pattern is great for this, finding a way to implement the underlying functionality to make sure, because what you want your automation to do is verify functionality, especially at that BDD level. So is the functionality working? I don't know what your device does. Can it still take a pulse? Can it still detect oxygen? Are these sensors still working, et cetera? That's the important thing for automation to figure out. And then often even 5 minutes actually using the UI directly can tell you whether, okay, these buttons aren't lined up at all, or the screen turns pink when I press this button. Those are things that automation can't necessarily detect. And those are great things for the human eye to go look at. Yep. So I would rather split those up. And then, again, automation works. If you can manipulate a level below the GUI, then I'm feeling a lot better about writing automation. You can still call it UI automation there, but I know that you're implementing something a little bit more reliable.
Right.
And you're probably getting more out of it than what you want. I want to go back to BDD for a minute because I'm a big fan and did a little bit of BDD work on Xbox. We didn't have a great way at the time to get the Gherkin stuff over the wire to the Xbox. But what I found out, and I'm not going to give a huge BDD explanation. People can look it up and figure it out. But when I work with some developers on our team on behavior-driven development, the huge benefit came not from the automation at the end that comes out of, I assume you're using some sort of Gherkin language for your BDD.
Good behavior.
Yeah. So just in thinking up front about what the behaviors were and describing what those are, that was the huge win for me. Automation is some icing at the end that you get some automation out of that at the end. But I found we got much better implementation, much less straying, much more accurate, much more often working right the first time, just when those developers thought about the behaviors and tried to describe them before they went and implemented the code. At a very minimum, for those curious about BDD, just do that first. And then if you can get some automation out of it at the end, that's fantastic too, to verify things. But in my experience, it's been a great way to influence good software design is describing those behaviors up front before implementation starts.
No, I totally agree. And that's how it should be done. But I guess I work for a very dysfunctional projects and
haven't we all before, right?
It's crazy. It's the benefit is the collaboration, the talking before you even develop anything. That's going to save you time in the long run. Not these flaky thousands of automated tests that, you know, it's going to be a nightmare to maintain. It's the actual discussion that you're having up front that's going to help with the reliability later on and to really uncover bugs before it even develops. So I definitely agree with you. I love BDD from what it's really for. But in my experience, I've seen teams that use it almost just as an automation framework. Rather than, you know, we're going to get 100% automation in our scenarios, our requirements. And so every requirement's going to have an automated test and we're going to be 100% automation and you know, everything's going to be happy.
This is where that tester mindset helps out,
right?
Because you and I, we see the big picture and how the system fits together. And often the people that don't have that tester mindset see, okay, here's a great tool we can use to achieve this. But no, you have to look at it in the big picture.
Right.
There was just an article, I don't know if you saw this, like a week ago, and a bunch of people have commented on it. This guy wrote an article, something called Scrum Should Die in a Fire. And he basically had a bad experience on dysfunctional teams implementing Scrum in what they called Scrum in strange ways. And it's exactly what you'd expect. Of course, if that was your view of Scrum, you go, yeah, this does suck.
Right.
But it's the same thing with BDD or any, we can call it automation, any tool you throw at something. If you look at it blindly as this tunnel vision kind of, this is a solution that's going to do this for me, you might end up in a place where it's not doing at all what you expected it to do for the product overall.
Right.
And I think your BDD stories fits that template pretty well.
It's good to hear that you're using BDD and it is helpful to your team. So that's good to know.
Yeah. And again, if you can just make people walk through that given when then, it's a great little mini specklet. I call a very small spec a specklet.
Cool. So in your experience, is there anything you see over and over again that most people doing test automation are doing wrong?
Most often, in my case, because I've worked a lot on operating systems, it's relying on behavior of the underlying software that they don't fully understand. That's probably one of the biggest ones I've seen. Like assuming something is, this button will always be 24 pixels wide.
Right, right.
Which you think, well, that's dumb. Sometimes it's just straight out programming errors because testers make them as often, at least as developers.
Yep.
Like you use less than when you meant to use greater than, and it worked fine for a while, or you should use less than equal or something. And a quick side note on that, this is one of the bombs I try and drop on people when they talk about flaky tests, is if you have tests that are failing that should be passing and you're okay with that, are you okay that you have tests that are passing that should be failing? Those are harder to find.
Yeah.
So it's important to have that reliability on both sides. True. And I think until you trust that your failing tests are not flaky, you can't trust your pass rate either.
Wow.
So yeah, that can be scary when you think about
it. Yeah.
But again, to be fair, not all classes of things that cause flakiness in failing tests can be applied to passing tests. But it's worth thinking about. So that's why you want to put that rigor, or at least craftsmanship is a better word, into all your tests so that you can, for me, it gives me more, the more I can trust my failed tests, the more I can trust my passing tests. And that's pretty important. Another big reason for failure is relying on behavior that you assume will always be there, but is not. Relying on networking existing, because it may not. Plenty of people use computers not connected to a network, even today. So being able to anticipate those things. Assuming, basically, it really comes down to assumptions. There's the general programming errors and then just failed assumptions. I can probably look at some code and think of some more, but those are probably the two biggest that come to mind.
Awesome. So I think you brought up a good point that if you don't have confidence in your tests that are passing, that's an issue. So do you recommend when people are writing automation that they follow the same TDD type practice where they make it fail first to get confidence that the test is really going to fail if it doesn't meet what they expect it to do?
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that. Full TDD, maybe not. It gets into that thing, who tests the test? Who tests the test that tests the tests? But there's a couple things as a tester that I do that I fall very close to that, which is, yeah, I want to see what, can I make this test fail? And either by manipulating the operating system or just changing a comparison operator, just to make sure that I know what it looks like when the test fails, and then I can diagnose from the failure. A lot of the feedback I gave to our developers in writing tests was, it's not enough to just fail. I don't know if there's an official metric on this, but mentally I track sort of mean time to diagnosis, which is when a test fails, how long does it take me to figure out why? Hmm. And we have testers sometimes spend half a day trying to figure out why their test failed. And I'm a little off your original question here, but when a test fails, I think if you have to go hook up a debugger or run the test again, you've lost.
Hmm.
You've lost the battle. I think you've won the battle when a test fails and you look at the log and within a minute or two or less, you can say, okay, most likely it's this. To me, it's sort of common sense. At least after 22 years, it's common practice. That's my biggest thing. But yeah, I do like to see the test fail. And often, because I've worked on operating systems a lot of my life, I work with kernel debuggers a lot, and I will do what I have called in the past exploratory debugging when I write tests. Hmm. I will write my test, and you can do this at application level as well. I will write where my test determines whether it's passed or failed, or the sort of the money part of the test. I'll set a breakpoint there, and I want to look and see what the operating system, what the variables look like, what's going on then when it passes and fails, so I get an idea of things I may want to log.
Yep.
It gives me some ideas there. There may be an error path in the code I'm testing that I want to exercise, so I can force the debugger to go over there and look through it, and that gives me more test ideas, those sorts of things. But anyway, to ask, answer your original question, I wouldn't necessarily go full on TDD for test development, but I do want to see what my tests look like when they fail while I'm writing them. So make sure I understand what that looks like and how that may influence other tests I'm writing.
Yeah, and I think you actually brought up an excellent point that it does sound like common sense, but in my experience, it's not. And that's when a test fails, that you just rerunning it to find out, did it pass? And if it did, then don't worry about it. That you need to know when it fails to be able to look at logs really quickly and know, okay, I know it failed because this assertion didn't match or something. Mm-hmm. When you have to, I forgot the name of the metric, I'll go back and write it. But
I called it mean time to diagnostics, yeah. But I may call it something different next time.
Okay. I think that's a killer metric. That was one of my questions. Are there any metrics you've found helpful in your career that actually are helpful and not just manager-driven? And I think that would be one example.
Yeah, but those are sort of personal metrics.
Yep.
Really, I'm not going to track that for, you know, Joe's tests. You know, how long do you take to figure out diagnostics? How long does Susan take? And therefore, Susan writes better tests. That's not necessarily true.
Well, in general, though, if you have a suite of tests that are failing and you're not there, someone needs to be able to look at those tests and see how long does it take to find that information out. I think at a high level, like you said, we should have good logs at least for that purpose.
Yeah, I think I'm big on efficiency. The one thing I took away from my Myers-Briggs that I did 15 years ago was my particular type abhors inefficiency. And I knew that beforehand, but now at least I know why. Sort of my personality types align and make me look at inefficient things and say, you know, WTF, and try and find a more efficient way to do them.
What are you, an INTJ or something, or ENTJ?
INTP.
INTP, cool. Are there any books or resources you would recommend to someone to learn more about testing or automation?
There's a statement I use, which is the answer to any sufficiently complex question is it depends. And it sort of depends on what you want to learn. So let me give you a few that are still, I think, would be relevant. I really like the book Beautiful Testing. I wrote a chapter in it, so shameless self-promotion, but there's some, if you want just a good breadth of different ideas of things around testing, everything from how to test random numbers to my chapter on large scale test automation to all over the place, it's a great sampler. Just because I believe there's a book by Stephen Johnson. You're going to get my whole book report now. I'm looking at a bookshelf full of my books here called Where Good Ideas Come From. And his premise is, among other things, is good ideas come when other ideas get together and mingle. So when you, these books that are a collection of essays, if you just want to get the good general idea of testing, I don't think it can be beat, the Beautiful Testing book. Or if you want to get a little bit more into automation case studies, the Dorothy Graham book also. I'm a fan of the collections of essays books for getting ideas around testing. For test automation, although it's a very difficult book to read cover to cover, I've probably learned, got the most ideas about test design, test automation design from Bob Binder's book on testing object-oriented systems. It sort of introduced me to patterns of test design, and I elaborated on those a little bit in How We Test Software at Microsoft. For just understanding functional testing, big fan of Lee Copeland's book, The Practical Guide to Functional Test Design, or something close to that. It's a nice little overview. Doesn't go too deep. It's kind of funny. I like his writing style.
Cool.
It's a good overview of functional test ideas. I'll stop there. Probably other ones, but the main thing is, like Stephen Johnson, ideas come from other ideas. And if you want to get a lot of great ideas, the way to get a lot of great ideas, actually, this is a Linus Pauling quote I'll throw in there before I get you this question. The way to get great ideas is to get a lot of ideas and then throw the bad ones away.
Nice.
So I believe that applies especially to test automation and testing ideas.
Awesome. I just want to give a shout out to your book, How We Test Software at Microsoft. Even though it's an older book, there's a lot of evergreen things in there. Like you said, there's a nice chapter on test patterns and also on model-based testing, I think.
Yeah, I still like the model-based testing chapter. It was the last chapter I wrote for the book, and I felt like I was finally getting on a roll then.
All right, so Alan, is there one piece of actual advice you would give someone who's trying to get started with testing or automation, And what is the best way to learn more about you or contact you?
That's two questions. Called it one, but it's two questions. The best way to learn probably about testing or test automation is get involved. And people that are listening to this podcast probably already know this because they're already have gotten outside of their office and outside of their workplace and discovered that the internet, among other things, can be a great place to learn. Get involved in some of the communities that are out there. And by being involved, just by like read, you know, Ministry of Testing and Testing Planet and Software Testing Club and follow some testers on Twitter and find some testing blogs and start shoving those ideas into your head so you can figure out which ones work and which ones don't work and interact with those people. Add a comment, ask a question on their blog post, ask a question on Twitter. I think if you get out of your office and use the internet, it's a great place to learn and get those ideas so you can throw away the bad ones or the ones that don't apply and figure out what the good ones are that work for you. And then if one of those people you want to interact with is me, of course, there's my blog, which you're going to link to, The Angry Weasel, yep, at angryweasel.com. People can email me at alan@angryweasel.com. That works. I'm on Twitter. You have links for these, Alan Page. I'm pretty easy to find on the internet, and I 95% of the time I can find time to reply.
Awesome.
Maybe even more than that. So I'm pretty accessible, I like to think.
You replied to me, so that's pretty accessible. So I appreciate it.
I replied to you on vacation.
Nice. Yes, that's right.
I had to do something on the lift. Yeah, I was skiing last week.
Very cool. Thank you, Alan, for your testing awesomeness. For links of everything of value that we talked about in this episode, head on over to testtalks.com/44. And while you're there, make sure to click on the More Info link under the exclusive sponsor section to learn about Sauce Lab's awesome products and services. If you're doing any type of testing, especially in a big enterprise, you want to check out Sauce Labs. And also, if you have a few seconds, I would really appreciate a review in iTunes. And if you leave a review, I will give you a shout out in an upcoming episode. So that's it for this week's episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with test automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.